Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Michelle Greenfield-Feig. On this week's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Laura Croft, veterinary scientist over scientific grants programs at the Morris Animal Foundation. We're going to provide a new perspective into the ways you can positively impact aquatic animal health beyond clinical work. Plus, we're going to highlight an interesting case Dr. Croft worked on involving developing milk for manatees. So without further ado, hi, Laura. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here with you, Michelle.
I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. But before we jump into what you're doing today with the Morris Animal Foundation, maybe you can give our listeners a little story about how you got to where you are today.
Absolutely. Similar to a lot of people in this field, I grew up in Florida and I wanted to be a marine biologist or a veterinarian. And then I had a high school marine biology class and they talked about different careers and mentioned a marine veterinarian. I thought, wow, that's perfect. It marries my two passions. So I went to undergrad saying that I was going to be an aquatic veterinarian. And when I was an undergrad, I had the unique opportunity to work at the New England Aquarium in their medical center. And that's where I was truly hooked. We were rehabilitating cold stem sea turtles and they were doing surgery on fish. And as a young undergrad student, mind blown. I just thought it was amazing. And so when I interviewed for vet school, I said, this is what I want to do. I want to be an aquatic veterinarian. I had the opportunity to do externships at different zoos in Aquaria. I did one at SeaWorld San Diego. And then one of my mentors actually said, if you want to go into this field, he recommended doing a small animal or equine internship to really nail down your medicine and surgery skills before you get into exotics or aquatics where your caseload may be low or really variable. And so I did that and then ended up going and doing a residency in aquatic animal medicine because that was my true passion. After I finished my residency, I worked at SeaWorld Orlando for almost 12 years. Had an amazing caseload being a clinical veterinarian, but I had married a guy from Colorado. And so finally he convinced me to move back so we could be closer to family. But there's not a lot of marine mammals in Colorado. So that forced me to shift. So I went and did zoo medicine, which was fun, but a little bit of a challenge. It was a little bit scary going from primarily aquatic to dealing with things with hooves and things that dwelled on land. So I was at the Denver Zoo for about 5 years, and one of the technicians, she was our veterinary operations manager at the Denver Zoo, had gone and worked at Morris Animal Foundation. So she recruited me to sit on one of the scientific advisory boards for Morris Animal Foundation, looking at kelp forest ecosystems. And I was fascinated reading about all of these research proposals and talking to other experts in the field about which research had the most merit and the most impact. So then when they had a job open up, I decided to apply, and I've been at Morris for the last 6 months.
What a great story. I'm sure many of our listeners can relate to shifting between treating aquatic and terrestrial animals. Any guidance for folks who might be in that situation?
For aquatic or exotic veterinarians, just lean into the fact that we are so adaptable. Our training allows us to do so many things, and we're so used to being uncomfortable and dealing with new species or species where we don't have all the information. So just lean into that. Know that a lot of what you know can be transferable. I used to tell aspiring vet students that if they didn't know what to do for a sea lion, you might be able to think of it as a dog and translate what you would do if it were a dog. An otter is an angry ferret or cat. So you can take some of what you know, and I definitely have done that throughout my career.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that advice. So let's focus on what you're currently doing, which is working as a veterinary scientist over scientific grant programs at Morris Animal Foundation.
It's a mouthful. And what it means is that I'm helping oversee our entire scientific grants program. So we have 4 different portfolios: canine, feline, equid, and then wildlife, which is really all encompassing. And so I'm helping to update our animal welfare policies to ensure that all the research we're funding is not only helping to fill critical knowledge gaps, but also that it's really safeguarding the health and well-being of all of the animals that are affected by the research. And so I'm updating those policies and also helping to guide our wildlife strategies. So really trying to figure out how we can make the most impact for the wildlife in our natural world.
You said you previously served on a committee where you were helping read applications to different grants. So is that part of what you're continuing to do?
I actually help to recruit those experts now. So we have external volunteer scientific advisory boards that review each and every proposal that come in, and they will deliberate on those proposals and decide which ones have the most merit and which ones we should fund. So that's one of the really neat things about our process, is that it really safeguards the merits of the research and ensures that we are funding the best research to make an impact. And when you have a wildlife open topic, that can be really difficult to do, to try and predict what topics are going to come in and what expertise you need. But if we don't have the expertise we need, we can always pull in additional reviewers, as what we call ad hoc reviewers. So I do get to interface with a lot of different experts. So I don't specifically weigh in on which proposals should be funded or not funded as a staff member anymore at Morse Animal Foundation.
What can folks who are listening who are applying for these keep in mind as they're putting together proposals?
I think having a really clear hypotheses and objectives on how you want to evaluate those hypotheses. We talk about statistics. That's incredibly important to make sure that your results are going to be meaningful. So I encourage all budding researchers to take a statistics course, or at least find a colleague who is really talented in statistics, to make sure that the results are going to be meaningful. And then finally, really lay out how your research will have an impact. What are your expected results, and what are you going to do with those? How are those going to translate into improving medicine for lesser known species like African penguins? How is that going to work towards either solving a problem or improving clinical medicine on the ground? Or how is that going to inform management strategies? Can you work with a regulatory agency that's overseeing them and help inform that management with this new knowledge that you've gained?
Thank you. That really helps me understand the sorts of things your team is looking for in research proposals. And it's also inspiring that you're able to push folks towards research with a purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that got me into this field was the idea that there wasn't a lot known. There were so many opportunities to add to the knowledge base and to push the medicine forward. And so I think that's really exciting. And hopefully all aquatic clinicians have research as a component of their job, or at least if they come across a weird case, we'll consider writing it up. It's really important not to be afraid of failure, because that is how we advance. So research your options and make sure that you're doing the safest thing possible. But even if you fail spectacularly, maybe share that with the field, and because inevitably someone else may have that idea. So I think it's really important for clinicians and researchers to share what they've learned, whether it's positive or negative.
Really, it's a team effort here.
Absolutely.
So how has this role helped shape the next step of your career and what you're trying to contribute to this veterinary community?
I know one of the themes that you've highlighted in a lot of your podcasts is that there is no one path. And hopefully my career trajectory is the perfect representation of that. I went from clinical aquatic medicine to clinical zoological medicine, and now in the nonprofit research sector. So there are a lot of different ways that all of us as veterinarians or researchers or biologists can impact the field. It was difficult for me to figure out how I could use my veterinary degree if I wasn't a clinician. But being able to work for a nonprofit in a research granting organization has allowed me to make an impact and contribute to aquatic medicine, maybe less directly, but in a larger way that may potentially impact the course of species and medicine. I'm helping to fund research that's filling those critical knowledge gaps, diseases that maybe drive certain species to extinction, or helping figure out new treatments. And I'm also helping to support future researchers as well, to have a sustainable population of really good researchers. I know you were a recipient of one of our veterinary student scholar grants.
Yes, thank you so much for bringing that up. So what I'm doing is creating a separate podcast series that walks through the scientific method and the process of publishing a paper using open source data in real time. My goal is that this can become a resource for students who may not have access to mentorship or the ability to do fieldwork on their own, and show them how they can still actively contribute to real research. So I'm intimately familiar with just how incredible the work is that the Morse Foundation does. It's really amazing.
Thank you. I think it is really exciting being able to support veterinary student scholars, fellows, postdocs, and really help them to break into the field, get the mentorship they need to do good research. Along the lines of what you're doing, disseminate those findings in different ways. I think just publishing in a peer-reviewed manuscript is maybe not enough these days. It's assumed that you're going to do that. But how else are you going to get that information out there to clinicians that maybe aren't attending a conference or don't happen to come across your journal article? And so I think disseminating the information in new and novel ways and taking advantage of how interconnected we are on the internet. So, and in some cases, how you're going to get that information to regulatory agencies or biologists that need that information. So engaging with stakeholders and collaborating, there's so much that we can all do together. So I think those are all really important things in making an impact and being a good researcher. Those are the things that we're looking at in those impact sections when we're evaluating different proposals. How are the researchers going to take that information and get it out to the people who need it or who want it?
That's quite helpful for everyone listening. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
I also love highlighting clinical cases on this podcast, and you have some really interesting ones from before you at the Morris Animal Foundation. What were some of your more memorable cases from your time at SeaWorld?
Some of the most memorable cases in my career were rehabilitating orphan manatee calves. Early in my career, I was told that they were challenging cases, but I had several that we were bottle feeding and seemed to be doing really, really well. And then they just went off of their food and we started doing diagnostics. And they just this horrible infection. So manatees and a lot of their relatives, elephants are prone to inflammation in their digestive tract when they're fed artificial milk. And that can actually transition to what's known as pneumatosis intestinalis, where they have gas bubbles in the wall of their gut. And so that prevents absorption of nutrients and can allow bacteria and infection from inside the intestine to go into the bloodstream and they go septic. And so it can be a fatal condition. And I lost several orphan manatee calves that I was helping rehabilitate to that condition. There is a syndrome that's similar in human infants. And so reading up on what they do in humans, they feed this really elemental formula that's easy to break down. And so we teamed up with a veterinary and human nutritionist to come up with a new formula for these manatees that would allow them to not only gain weight, but be able to resolve this pneumatosis that was happening in their guts. To date, that's actually still the formula that a lot of the rehabilitation facilities in Florida are using. So we really designed it to most closely mimic a manatee's milk. So there was some information on the makeup of the manatee milk in terms of the percentage of protein, the percentage of fat, and even the breakdown of the different amino acids. We tried to match it as closely as we could in the different fatty acids. How much omega-3s or medium chain triglycerides do we need to bring in? And from there, it was a little bit of trial and effort too to figure out what was going to be palatable that the manatee calves would like and that they would grow on. So a manatee calf should gain about 1/2 pound a day. They grow very, very quickly. And especially these orphan calves can't be returned to their natural environment until they're over 600 pounds, because that seems to be the cutoff where they're less susceptible to cold stress syndrome. And so it is important for them to be able to grow so that they can reach that milestone and be eligible for release in their natural environment.
When they were coming in, did you find that a lot of them were so emaciated that you were concerned about something like refeeding syndrome, or were they just orphaned but within decent body condition that you could go ahead with a routine feeding schedule?
It really varied. Got in some units, had a fresh umbilicus, and probably had either never nursed or only very briefly nursed. And in those, we did worry about failure of passive transfer. So we had hydrolyzed antibodies from healthy manatees that we used to add to the milk. Whether or not that made a difference, I don't know. But if I was really concerned that that manatee had never nursed, sometimes we would give antibodies directly into their vein, IV, and also orally, just to see if we could help bolster their immune system, make them a little less susceptible to secondary infections. But we did sometimes have really emaciated calves where we did worry about refeeding and would take a transition really slow. So usually with those animals, if they're dehydrated, we would start with clear fluids and then slowly add in a formula starting at maybe a 25% where you're taking the full strength formula and diluting it 3-to-1 with water or an electrolyte solution and slowly increasing it as that manatee can tolerate and making sure that they're continuing to defecate or poop and basically that everything's working and doing what it's supposed to do.
I have a patient right now in hospital that is severely emaciated and we're slowly trying to get it back to eating, knowing how difficult it can be and how even increasing its feeding by just a small amount, if you're going too far, too fast, can have serious detriments. So I understand the slow and steady for many of these animals is so important in order to make sure that they have a good recovery.
Absolutely. And each patient is an individual. So I like to joke that our patients don't always read the books. We can have a standard protocol, and then you always have to be able to step back and adapt to your individual patient.
And I'm sure many of our listeners are aware that there's a lot going on with the Florida manatees, and there's a UME or an unusual mortality event currently happening. But why are we seeing so many orphans coming in? And why has this been a thing that's been continuous for many years?
We don't always know what happens to the moms. We do know that manatee moms and calves have a very tight bond, and they will usually be with their calves for 1 to 2 years and really don't leave their side. So if there's a calf all by itself without a parent there for hours, then the fish and wildlife biologists usually determine that that calf has been orphaned and will bring it in for rehabilitation because an orphaned calf has minimal to no chance of survival on its own. But as far as what happens to mom, it could be a vehicle collision. Obviously, collisions with boats are a big threat to manatees, or even enough boat traffic caused them to be separated and they couldn't rejoin. A lot of what we're seeing right now is related to seagrass beds just being completely depleted and they're starving to death and trying to find novel food sources, and that doesn't always go well. It shifts the flora in their digestive tract, and manatees are like a lot of herbivores, rabbits, and horses, where if you don't have a healthy digestive tract, you're not going to have a healthy animal.
Yeah. And was it something like once they started taking this new formula and were doing well on it, you weren't seeing any side effects of digestive issues and it was resolving fairly quickly?
I wouldn't say we completely avoided digestive issues. We would occasionally still see digestive issues, but it seemed to be less, and we could treat the orphan manatees through those issues and they would still continue to gain weight. So we could still resolve pneumatosis while they were on this diet, as opposed to other diets where we just weren't able to get in front of it and treat those conditions while they were on that diet because it was just too difficult and too foreign. And so some of it may even be an autoimmune thing where you're putting in so much foreign material and so their gut immunity goes a little bit crazy and forms this pneumatosis. At least that's one of the hypotheses behind why that syndrome occurs.
Well, and given that there aren't that many places that have manatees, we have to learn from rehabbers, mostly trial by error. Like you said before, we have to be willing to make mistakes because that's the way that we learn. So I'm sure all the manatees that you and your colleagues have treated and the ones in the future are quite appreciative of the work that you went into to figure out a better formula.
Thank you. I hope so. That was actually the story that I wanted to tell Alex Trebek when I was on Jeopardy. But instead, he went for low-hanging fruit and asked me about my name. But I really wanted to talk about helping to develop a new hand-feeding formula for orphan manatee calves.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to bring it up regardless. You were on Jeopardy. And yes, I agree, that would have been 100 times better story. But since you're one of the few that have been on Jeopardy, what was that experience like?
It was an amazing experience, and I'm so glad that I did it. I decided that I wanted to be on Jeopardy because it was something I had always watched with my folks, and my father had passed away. And so we had always joked that he should be on Jeopardy because he had this encyclopedic knowledge. And so I think when he passed away, I decided that I was going to do it because he didn't get a chance to. And so I took the online test and I did the interview, and And I had the opportunity to film, which was just incredible. It's a lot of fun, but a timing is everything on Jeopardy. That the buzzer is really tricky to figure out. And I think there are folks that have grown up and done quiz bowls. And that wasn't me. I was just the kid that watched it on the couch and decided it would be really fun to go on. So I never quite figured out the buzzer. You don't know what the categories are. Everybody asks if they give you the categories ahead of time. You have no idea. I had a category about palmistry, reading palms, which was totally wild and definitely not in my knowledge base. But there are some categories that come up regularly. I think Shakespeare, geography. So I tried to study some of those things and bolster my knowledge. But sure enough, I actually did get a geography question on Final Jeopardy, and my mind completely went blank. I could not remember which country Baku was the capital of. It's Azerbaijan, in case you're wondering. But it wasn't just that. It wasn't which country, but it was which body of water it was on. And I kind of knew it was in Asia, but all I could think of was Lake Baikal, because I think I had read an article several weeks before about a big December outbreak or an influenza outbreak in seals there. So that's what I wrote for my final Jeopardy answer, which was not correct. It was the Caspian Sea. But I think it was an apt ending for an aquatic veterinarian to blank and only think of the lake where she could remember an outbreak of distemper in seals.
What a great story. And we're all wishing you made it to another episode and got that one right. But you went with what you thought you knew and based on a paper. And I get you. I also had auditioned and I made it to the in-person interview for the college tournament. I never made it on. And they have you write a couple fun facts about yourself to talk about. And I had just worked at Sandcob the summer before and thought, oh, penguins. I'm personable. This is great. They'll want me. I might not know everything, but they'll want me on TV. And let me tell you, they did not want me on TV. I think I had not studied my Shakespeare and geography enough, but what a great experience.
Well, it was definitely their loss, and I would have loved to hear about penguins.
Right, and manatees too. So all of our listeners, this is your opportunity to shine. The online test is now available all year round. You can take it whenever you want. Today's the day. Challenge yourself. Go home, take the online test. We hope you make it. When you're in that in-person interview, definitely talk about the crazy stuff you do. Get yourself on TV. Let us know here at Aquadox if you make it. You will have a whole cheering squad from around the world cheering you on when you are on Jeopardy. And we wish you the best of luck. Please let us know.
Definitely. I would encourage everybody that is interested to try it. It's fun and it's good for us to get outside of our comfort zones and pull out knowledge that we may not use every day.
And also going back to something that you and I had talked about earlier today, how do we disseminate information about what we do? And I think one of the cool things when we were watching you on Jeopardy as a family was, wow, there's this veterinarian who's working at an amazing institution and representing the aquatic veterinary force on a national television program. And even though you don't get to highlight too much about what you do, the fact that you're there and you're saying, this is what I do, here I am as an intelligent individual getting to participate in this thing that is just common in everyday American life, is really something special in a way that we all get to contribute to the larger community, not just the scientific community, but the general public to promote the great work we do.
Absolutely. I think the more that we can figure out how to reach the general public and make them care about what we're doing. So, I mean, why should they care about African penguins potentially going extinct by 2035 and really get them to rally to action and why this research matters? I think at Morris Animal Foundation, it's great that we have this money that we can give out to researchers, but it's never enough. We always have more proposals that are recommended for funding than we can actually fund. And that's what breaks my heart and keeps me awake at night, is how can we continue to fund more studies and fill those knowledge gaps to improve health and well-being for all animals around the globe.
And before I let you go, any advice you'd like to share with our student listeners?
I think the biggest advice that I give to prospective aquatic veterinarians is to never burn bridges. We're such a small community. You really never know where your next opportunities are going to come from. So don't burn bridges and make the time to get out there and network and find out what people are doing and just be open to different opportunities, because you never know where they're going to lead.
Maybe from manatees to hoofstock.
There you go. That's right. Manatees, dekudu, to research. So it's okay. Your path doesn't have to be straight. It can be winding, zigzag. Make your path and just embrace how adaptable we are, that we're comfortable with being uncomfortable and treating new things and learning new things, trying new things. And that's one of the things that I love about this field is there are so many different ways to make an impact.
Well, Dr. Kraft, thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Michelle. This was great.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Laura Kraft for being on the show this week, our sponsors WAVMA, AAFE, and the Cornell Wildlife Health Center, and all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars and leave a review. I'm Michelle Greenfield-Feig, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.